map of my route through Europe.
Yep.
So yeah, you can't quite see it. It's about 6,000 kilometers through Europe over about 3 months of cycling. And I ended spending Christmas. So I actually flew, I'd lined up a church in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. So I flew from Istanbul to Tbilisi and spent Christmas and New Year at this amazing American missionary family in Tbilisi. Another recommendation is go to Tbilisi. It's an amazing country. Georgia's an amazing mountainous country, but Tbilisi is the capital city. It's a kind of a city in a bowl surrounded by mountains. The exchange rate is unbelievably beneficial for us, so everything's very cheap. Interesting culture, food, people are very friendly, so yeah.
Hope you're taking notes of all of these recommendations.
So this is the first leg done. I think it says somewhere at the top there, September through to December.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of temptation to stop at that point, or did you know this is just the first of the first leg of a bigger journey?
I think for me, I'd set out, for the charity side to get to Manila, and that was what I was going to do.
Great.
So one thing as well was, I haven't really touched on so much, but kind of the routine of cycling and what I do each day. So I pack up my tent. Generally, I'll have about 6 hours of cycling. That might be up to 8 or 9 kind of on the bike. But for the first, because I'd committed it to have those kind of deeper purposes, for the first hour on the bike, I'd always, every morning, have something that I'd pray for. So I'd start just in my mind, just like praying, like maybe thanking God for the things that I'd been given, and then have a specific kind of group of people that I would be praying for each day. And that was a great routine to get me through that first hour of the day. And then from then on, I had kind of different ways to tackle each hour in terms of my mind. Sometimes, or normally after lunch, so 3 hours before lunch, 3 hours after lunch. Normally after lunch, I'd listen to podcasts on my phone, download a load of podcasts at the start of the week and listen to them. And that's one thing that, on reflection of my now last year, is just, it was an amazing year to have so much time to think and to pray. Like, in the business of life now, I do that probably a lot less simply because of the time I have. So that was great. And then, in terms of continuing, another thing that made sure I continued was I was praying about the next stage, the next leg, where should I fly on to past the Middle East? And I had been as a teacher on a school trip to India just the July before I'd left. And I kind of wanted to cycle through India for the intensity of experience, the culture, the people. And I went through Greece, and in Thessaloniki in Greece, I met an Indian pastor, and his name was Stanley, and he was incredibly friendly. And I shared with him about my cycle, my story, and he said, "Come to my house, you're coming. And remember what you have to say?"
Yes.
Yes. So Stanley said, "If you come to Mumbai, I will pick you up and I'll make sure that you get a good start of your cycle in India." So New Year came, I'd got a ticket from Istanbul to Mumbai, and that was then leg two.
So, in a similar way, tell us a little bit about setting out, for the second time in a very different environment. Did it feel different, kind of?
I think I think you have to be kind of reasonably self-confident. But in flying from Istanbul to India, I remember ringing my sister, and get on really well with my sister, and do keep up with her quite a bit. She's great to chat to. And I remember ringing her, and I broke down in tears because it was just the unknown of the next stage. And so I just felt like a lot of pressure building up on me, and probably a bit of expectation as well. I'd started to share my trip a lot, and lots of people were enjoying following it. And, like I just said, I wanted to make sure I got to the end point. And I think, in different cultures, and this then actually became even more so in India, It's great, and the people you meet are amazing, and the hospitality is amazing, but you only really truly relax when you're around someone of a very similar culture to you. So to be able to communicate with my sister, it wasn't until that moment that I kind of was able just to explain maybe some of the thoughts and feelings that I was going through. And I remember, yeah, I kind of had this conversation, was a bit teary, didn't I know what was what. And then I had to rush to the airport as well, and it was all a bit stressful, like packing your bike up, putting it on a plane, you put it into a big cardboard box, you take it apart, you pray that it's going to come out okay the other side. One of my favourite parts, which must have looked very funny on several occasions, was cycling out of the front door of an airport, airport-like doors, because people must think, how did he do that? But yeah, just with an alloy key and a bike, you can put it together. Yeah, so I remember getting to the airport, and it's actually worked out okay, the flight, some slight issues. And then I got to India, and I think whereas Europe, it was very much about the adventure of camping, and that was a big theme. India was another level in terms of the cultural impact and the intensity. And in India, you've got five senses, and 100% of the time, all of those five senses are being hit, just bombarded with the taste, the sounds, the smells, the people, the energy, the heat. The noise, it was crazy. But from day one, I knew it was going to be okay. Got to the airport, 6 a.m., Stanley turns up in this huge car with two of his friends, and they're all leaders of churches in this area of Mumbai he's from. He'd driven 2 hours to get there, so they must have left at, 5 a.m. or something. They pick me up from the airport, they take me back to his house. En route, they take me to for breakfast, they take me to meet another one of their friends, and then we get to his house, and he said, you must be tired, go and have a rest. And for the next four nights, I stayed at different friends of his, and I stayed twice with Stanley. And Stanley had three children, his wife and him, so five of them, and they lived in this small house of two rooms, and they made sure that one room was my room, and the bedroom I slept each night, and his wife and his kids shared the other room on the sofas. And I learned a lot in India, but one thing I learned was I always had to say yes. And if I it's quite a British thing, actually, to someone offers you something and you say, no, it's fine. But what I realized time and time again in India, probably more so than in any other place, was I was often the white guy that was the first white guy that had ever maybe visited their town or village. And they would offer me all sorts of hospitality, food, maybe a bed to stay. And if I said no, they'd always remember the time the white guy came and said no to them. And saying yes to their hospitality is saying yes to them as a person. Or saying yes to their very spicy curry is saying yes to them as a person. So that's definitely a way to connect with people. It's just by accepting their hospitality. So I kind of learned that I didn't want to be rude in saying no. So I just had to take what they were giving me, and that led me into all sorts of situations where I was given amazing hospitality.
Wow, it's just incredible. I'm aware that we're trying to condense a lot of kilometers or a lot of miles into a short space of time.
Yeah.
So
that's the route through India. So I initially went south from Mumbai down to Goa. Got to Goa, and then I went east through the center to a city called Hyderabad, which is kind of a tech city. And that's where the school that I visited as a teacher was located. And there was an amazing moment where I cycled through the entrance to this school, and they gave me a guard of honor welcoming me in. And they just so happened it was Independence Day the next day. So they had a huge, celebration and assembly, and they got me on stage to say a few words, and then sent me off again. And then I cycled east to the coast to Vijayawada, Vishakhapatnam, up through this state called Orissa, and then finally to Calcutta. Mm. Again, yeah, amazing experiences. One funny story was I got the first week I kind of set out, and I'd come fresh from camping in Europe, and I thought, I've camped in Europe, I'll camp in India. What you don't realize about Asia is, so if you this afternoon went on a walk into the countryside, you could have enjoyed some nice footpaths and some nice, seemingly quite quiet, peaceful places. In India, that does not exist. There's people living in every single place. So you think you're on your own on a little kind of footpath, and then a family pop out, and or you set your tent up here, and then someone's weeing next to it or something. So I quickly realized that camping in India was going to be 10 times as stressful as Europe simply because you can't be hidden. So in that first week, I actually persisted and camped, but got incredibly stressed, ended up in a couple of hairy situations. I haven't got time to tell a story, but one night in particular, there was this kind of truckers' yards that truck drivers were using to have like snacks, and it was late at night. It was the only place I could find, so I stopped there. Said, "Oh, can I camp here?" And they didn't really speak much English. They kind of said yes. I wasn't sure what the situation was. There was a drunk guy asking me for money. I was just, you know, pretending that I didn't understand him. Luckily, there was lots of people around, so it wasn't just me and one weird drunk guy or whatever. And then at the end of the night, the guy said, "Oh, no, don't camp. You can come with me up here." So I followed him, and obviously I said, "Yes, okay." So I followed him, led me to this kind of small concrete building. And, you know, a shop window has a big shutter that you pull down. So we got inside. There's three of us, and we all sat inside ready to sleep in this tiny little room. There's a great picture, I don't think I've included it actually, of us in this room, three of us, one with a big kind of big belly and on him. And the guy goes to pull down the shutter. He pulls it down, and he gets his padlock, and he puts it on the thing. And I'm like, oh, mum and dad, oh. Like, and then he turns around to me, and then he just goes, thumbs up. And he didn't secure the padlock, he just put it over it. And I think what he was saying was, "Oh, don't worry, the drunk guy's outside, we've locked him out, we're inside, we're safe." Luckily, I'm a good sleeper, fell asleep, woke up in the morning, and it was all good. So on I went, and these guys love me.
That is incredible. So what we're seeing in front of us, if you can still see the screen, that in its entirety, India is part two of the four stages.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, so take us quickly through the next two parts. I don't know if you've got the images for them, and then maybe pick up on some stories as a whole.
Just one on the India in terms of churches, I think for me, the church experience. I was away for 8 months, and every Sunday for 8 months, I visited a church, bar one Sunday, I couldn't find a church, and that was in the mountains of Laos. So having these church experiences every week was incredible. And in Europe, I sometimes was interviewed or just acknowledged from the front. And after 1 week of cycling from Mumbai to Goa, I turned up in Goa, and I'd been put in contact with a guy that led a church. He turned up on his huge motorbike. He was quite a bit of a bodybuilder, quite an intimidating guy, but a very good looking, you know, similar to your pastor. a really nice guy. He turns up, and I say to him, what are you going to be talking on this weekend at the church? And he had four services that weekend. He says, "Simon, you're talking." And I thought, yes, that's it. So 2 hours later, I was stood in front of this first service of four. He also told me that he'd never preached the same sermon twice. Mm. So I had four to fill and make it slightly different. Luckily, I'd been writing this blog through Europe. So I'd been kind of linking a lot of stories from the road into kind of messages of faith. So I had a few stories to tell, and if I didn't speak for long enough, he'd just get up and speak for another 15 minutes anyway, so he could do that. So that was good. And then I was passed pretty much from church to church in India, going from, they called up the next guy and say, "Oh, we've got this cycling pastor." I'm not a pastor. "We've got a cycling pastor, he's coming through, can he come and speak at your church?" So I would turn up, and they'd give me this amazing hospitality, And then it turned into, in the midweek as well, and it turned into Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I would have very few nights off on my own. Sometimes I would just try and be on my own. And then the intensity of it as well, like in India, cycling along probably 30 times a day, it seemed like an hour, a guy would pull up alongside me on his motorbike, a lot more motorbikes or mopeds out there, and he would start quizzing me, like, "Why are you here? What's your purpose? What are you doing? What are you eating? Where are you sleeping? Like, how much is your bike? How much is your phone? How much do you earn? Like, what do you do? Who's your sister? Who's your mother?" And I actually learnt the questions they'd asked me. So if I was feeling a bit tired and a bit drained, I'd just say, I'm Simon, I'm from London, I'm a teacher, this costs £2,000, this does this, this costs, you know, and I'm going here. And often the best way to make them smile was to name all the foods that I was eating. I was like, So I like the dosa, the idli, the pani puri, and they would always be like, he's authentic, he knows what he's talking about. So that was India, got to the end of India, and I was ready to leave, if I'm honest, because it kind of hit me at the end that, yeah, like I said earlier, I hadn't maybe fully relaxed. I'd loved the hospitality, but it was starting to become a bit draining. So the guy that I mentioned, I met first day of uni, came out to Calcutta, and we spent about 10 days in Calcutta. It was actually Valentine's Day, so quite romantic that he met me on that day. And that was nice. That was nice. Just a refresher, like, first great mate that I'd seen in, four or five months. And just, halfway through the trip, great way to kind of refresh and reflect and process and then plan for the next phase. So we're going to overrun here, aren't we? It's just got a couple of pictures of, this is Stanley, who picked me up from the airport, and the guys there. This was getting welcomed onto a stage at a festival, because when you're an Englishman in India, you are a celebrity. This was a pastor that I stayed with. He used to be a milk farmer and a very generous family. And this was an experience of a village church you just met on a rooftop and in the middle of nowhere. And that was their prayer meeting in this village church. And also fascinating about India was everyone in India is a Hindu or from a Hindu background, because it's a Hindu country. Even if you're a Christian, you have come from a Hindu kind of past. And hearing some stories of people converting from Hinduism to Christianity, but also hearing about Hindus that were asking for prayer and coming to Jesus because they saw that other people were being helped out by this Jesus guy. Yeah. And they were Hindus, but they were asking for prayers from Christians. So then I left India, Calcutta, and I flew to Thailand and Bangkok, and spent this leg of the journey going up through Southeast Asia. This is probably when my motivation waned the most. India, actually, surprisingly, it wasn't that hot, and I got to Bangkok, came out of the airport, and it was hot, 40 degrees, very sticky, and I was a little bit like, this is just a bit overwhelming. Thankfully, just at the right time, I met this guy, and he was a man called David, and he turned up one night at the place I was staying, and he was from Paris, and it turned out we were going on the same leg, or we were going the same kind of route. And for about 2 weeks, me and David ended up cycling together. And it was a great time, because it was another answer to prayer in some ways. I'd become a bit kind of demotivated, a bit lonely. Just the right time, I met this French guy, and we got on so well. And spent 2 weeks cycling together. He became a bit of a brother. He had some great sayings, like, I need some fuel. And every time he got hungry, I need some fuel. And we'd stop and we'd get some fuel. And he's like, this is perfect. That was, everything was perfect. It was so perfect. And then we cycled for another half an hour. I need some fuel. We came through this. I think I ate more with David than the rest of the trip. But going through the mountains. In fact, one morning, it was slightly sad that David, his family back home, the reason for his trip was, I think there'd been some kind of deaths in his family. And then he found out another family member was a bit unwell. So one morning he got up and he said, I've got to go to the airport. And that was quite a shock for me, because I'd got used very quickly to his company, 2 weeks cycling together. And he went, like, we had breakfast, he went, and then I was on my own again. And I suddenly felt very alone, because I'd had his company. And I was cycling that day in Lao, and it was, that morning was about 4 hours cycling uphill. And I was just questioning again, like, what am I doing? And I had to come back again to the kind of the values of what I was doing, the charity, the reasons I was doing it for the churches, and then the kind of the purpose of the trip. And I don't think I've got time to say the story in its entirety, but it was funny, but that kind of, again, that moment of desperation led to one of the most incredible stories from the whole trip again, in that I was up in this mountain in Laos, couldn't find anywhere to eat, and eventually came to this little shack at the side of the mountain. And generally in Southeast Asia, there are just food stalls everywhere. So you don't need to have to plan that well, because there's just people selling food everywhere, and it's incredibly cheap. And these guys in this little shack were singing karaoke, and it's quite different to British culture that everyone loves karaoke and there's no shame in it. And if you laugh at someone doing karaoke, you offend them a lot, whereas, you know, we kind of do that quite naturally.
I thought that's what it was for.
Yeah, exactly, for just laughing at people. So there was these boys in this little shack in this mountain doing karaoke, and they said, oh, come here, they tried to get me to sing. And one of them spoke a little bit of English, and in that part of Laos, no one speaks English. So I was like, oh. And pretty much he invited me then to come and meet his family, which led into me staying with his family for a couple of nights in this tiny little village in Laos. They had a fire on their dirt floor that they cooked over. They had one bedroom with four beds in each corner, and his mum and dad, his older brother and his brother's wife, his younger brother, and then him. When we ended up going to bed, he's like, come, and then I ended up getting into the double bed with him, and it was quite cute. We were like, good night, and I said, good night, and a bit surreal. And earlier on, he'd said to me, oh, are you ready to wash? And in that part of Asia, it was often out of a saucepan. You just get the water on top of you, lather up. And then he took me on his motorbike to the wash point in town, and everyone stripped off to their underwear, and then there was this bamboo pole coming out of the mountain, sending water over this plank of wood. And I already was getting a lot of attention, and I realized, he wants me to get in my underwear. I'm gonna get all sorts of looks here. So, but I had to say yes. So I got in there, and I was next to these women, the mums of the village, you know, using my towel and my shampoo, and they were laughing at the white guy and how white I was.
There are no photos of that, right?
No.
Okay, good. Just checking.
This was the guy. His name was Lilu, and he also had a pack of cows that we went and saw down in the valley, just beneath the village he stayed in. This was their house. Just outside their house, and this was them eating all together on the floor. Amazingly generous again, and just one short thing was, as I went, I often gave pictures of my family to say thank you, and as I said earlier, like, talking about family is a big connection, and they want to know about your sister or my parents, and I gave him a picture of my family, and often I found this was a reaction, was to be so thankful, but straight away, he went to his drawer, probably got out one of his only very few pictures, and gave me a picture of one of his school kind of graduation pictures from his first school. And then he wrote a message on the back, and it's in Lao. I don't know how to say the language, but when I was 15 years old, I was a student at second year of secondary school. He wrote there with that was Lilu, yeah.
Amazing. So. Fast forwarding,
I'm really sorry. I feel like we could stay till 10 o'clock and hear more, but I'm aware that we need to commit to the time that we said that we'd finish by. But do feel free to grab Simon. I think that most of your blog is still accessible as well.
Yeah,
so there's insight if you want to go away from here and find out more. Do that. But so tell us about finishing the journey.
Yeah, so as a geography teacher, I taught a lot about the Philippines to the students, and a quick tour is, the Philippines is a group of 7,000 islands, largely volcanic, and that doesn't sound very ideal for cycling. But because I'd set out to cycle to Manila, I thought, I've got to, at least on the last leg, cycle. So I ended up getting a flight to the second city in the Philippines called Cebu, which is on Cebu Island, and then spent about 3 weeks cycling up through the Philippines, getting ferries in between to the capital, Manila. And Philippines is an amazing country to visit. It's easy to visit as an English person because they've got a history of American influence, so most people speak English on some level. And the 7,000 islands and volcanoes meant that I ended up sleeping underneath a volcano one evening and was woken up by this farmer who'd let me stay there, and he took me on a little tour of the base of the volcano on his white horse, which was another very surreal experience, but amazing hospitality again. And then after cycling for those weeks in the Philippines, I ended up visiting the office of the charity IGM. So this was, what I'd been building towards. I'd visited offices in Calcutta, in Cebu, and then finally in Manila in the Philippines. And this final stop off was an amazing experience because these guys never met me. They all turned out, well, it was their working day, but they all came and welcomed me. They'd all written me messages of thanks for raising money and for doing some work to kind of publicize the charity. Very welcoming. Did a radio interview in the Philippines in Manila and shared a little bit more about IGM. And that's, so what IGM is, it's an anti-slavery charity, and it's actually the largest one in the world. And they work, you can kind of see from the screen, but they work to rescue victims, restore victims, and then put criminals to justice, and then also put justice systems in place. So looking like a sustainable model, so that when the police go, the criminals don't just start doing what they did again, but looking to put in systems in place so that people aren't caught up in slavery. And it's devastating, really. But in the Philippines, the main sort of slavery is children being used on webcams for Westerners to do like kind of sexual exploitation. So it's called OSEC, the online sexual exploitation of children. And I heard some awful stories of young Filipino kids as young as babies being used on video cameras and it being sent back to people in the UK, Europe, Australia, America. And obviously it's pretty challenging to find where these people are, and you have to get them at the right place at the right time to get enough evidence. You have to use a big team. So that's what IGM do. They link together kind of local, they work with the police, they go in, they arrest people, they rescue the victims, then they get on board on making sure that they recover well and they don't just go back into the same situation. And then they look to prosecute those people that were the perpetrators. I heard some incredible stories of how that worked out. Joined in some prayer meetings with the people that are doing that. And it was a great way to tie up and really value the journey. And then since then, that's led on to me being more involved in the work of IGM, serving at different camps, and even doing like the odd thing like this, just publicising it. And I'd encourage you guys to go and look at their work. They've got some great kind of short videos on YouTube about different work in different places. It's not just about that work I mentioned in the Philippines, but they work in parts of Africa, in India. Often it's bonded labor, so they'll take away maybe someone's passport and then they're kind of stuck in a place, or they're told that they're gonna promise this and then they end up having very different situations and working long hours in brick kilns or fishing or something like that. So,
I mean, really, really challenging stuff, and I guess stuff that it's so easy to turn a blind eye to in our comfort and our privilege. But I mean, thank you for bringing it to our attention and to many more people's attention through what you did. You mentioned a little bit about life since.
Yeah.
You're back teaching.
Yeah.
It must be quite weird. All that you experienced, all that you saw. What was it like coming back into being a teacher in Southeast London? And
it's strange. Whatever is in front of you and you do quickly becomes your norm. So as much as those experiences, and even it's nice for me tonight to kind of relive some of those, whatever you're currently doing quickly becomes normal. I certainly learned some great lessons from the trip, and one of them was the hospitality thing, but more than that, to value people. And people are brilliant, but also very frustrating. And one thing that the UK has is like an epidemic of loneliness, of anxiety, of depression. And I saw all these people that had so little across India, Asia, and they had none of that. But what they did have was constant community. And they had maybe 6 or 7 brothers and sisters living in the same bedroom growing up. And if I stopped by the side of the road, there'd quickly be a crowd next to me all the time. And community was that easy. And people always were hanging out in front of the houses, and I kind of realized when we get back to the UK, people don't do that in the UK. People don't just sit outside their houses. They sit outside the back of their houses for privacy, and I definitely felt an encouragement to make sure I remind myself of the importance of community and finding community in whatever shape or form, or making yourself open to people. And I think I have been like this for a while, but yeah, if it is somebody that serves you at a shop, like asking them how their day is, or asking them, one of the best things you can do is say, how are you, to someone. And it sounds so simple, but if you say, how are you, people are like, what? How am I? What do you mean, how am I? How am I? So something, yeah, try it this week. Say, how are you? And see how many people you surprise. And I'm very aware that the stories that I had from Europe, India, I could tell a story from the last week of someone that I've had a nice connection with. Because if you make that a life decision that you're going to say yes to strangers, or you're going to engage with people that you don't normally, then you don't have to go on a 8-month cycle to the Philippines. You can do it in the here and now, and have some great stories just from living a normal life in the UK. I know you asked about what I've learned, and I think there's the kind of journey of faith as well. And one thing that was a really nice way to wrap up the trip was that I actually ended up visiting the guy that wrote the book that inspired me. He lives in Hong Kong. And I had messaged him, emailed him, and he said, if you do the trip, come and stay with me. And it didn't work out to cycle through Hong Kong. But on the way home, I flew back via his house in Hong Kong. And I spent some time with him, his wife, and his kids. And it was a really good way to process, because he'd done a big trip himself. He was now, he'd moved on. He was into work again. He was a Christian. And for me, my faith grew massively in the year. Like I had to depend on someone, because I didn't know where I was going to sleep each night. I didn't know if that guy was going to mug me. So I was incredibly maybe not nervous, not because I was depending completely on me, but because of faith. And I feel that that's one of the great things about faith. It doesn't put the onus on you. It means that you've got God to trust in. And at the end of the day, if the worst thing happens, and, well, this sounds awful, but if the very worst does happen, you still have faith, and you still have hope of something more. But also in coming back and chatting to this guy Rob right at the end of my trip, it actually gave me even more questions about my faith. He mentioned some things, and I thought, oh yeah, like I'm not actually sure about what I believe about this, and I've never actually thought about why I believe this and this. So actually coming back for the last year, like, it's actually been difficult in some ways, or a big journey of faith, where I've had to really wrestle with some of the things that I've always believed. Meeting people in India that are Hindus and have never had an opportunity to experience church and God, and you think, some Christians preach a message of heaven and hell, and I don't want to get into that conversation now, but I think, like who am I to say this person's going here, this person's not? And it made me really look into what I believe in terms of, faith, life, what's going to happen to all of us. But the good news is there's hope. So.
There is definitely hope.
We're gonna draw stumps, although the more you say, the more questions I have. just so that you know, Simon hasn't arrived back home and stopped challenging himself. You recently ran the marathon in a ridiculous time. What was your time for the marathon?
I think my outlet for the adventure now is I do a bit of cycling. I generally cycle or run to school where I'm a teacher. And I've run the London Marathon for the fourth time this April, and I ran a PB, 2:34 I ran, so it was about top. So I ran, it was top 200, and there's about 44,000 runners or so. I showed all the kids, because on the start line, I was behind Mo Farah. They all the elites kind of start 10 yards ahead of you, and there's a gap, and then there's the good club runners. And I made sure I got to the front row, and I was like, yeah,
Top 200 in the London Marathon is just, I mean, just incredible.
Yeah.
And I think we'll end there before we, you know, before we get any more envious.
Can I just read, read out one thing?
Please do.
On reflecting, I just thought this was a nice message to end on, something I haven't read or even remember for quite a while, but it was just from my last, when I was coming home, I wrote just down this reflection. I thought it might be helpful for some people. it was on muscles, and I just wrote down, like, right at the end of my trip, I said, faith is like a muscle. It's there, but becomes more visible and larger when we use them, or when we use it. And this requires new things, or this requires action. And I wrote down, when have my legs hurt the most on this 8 months of cycling? I said, in the last 2 days, when I've started doing squats, I thought I need to, you know, start maybe getting back in the running shape. And I just thought, yeah, that's a good analogy, that if we want to be full of faith, we've got to do new things. Like, don't expect your faith to grow by doing the same old thing. You've got to step out of your comfort zone. Wow. You've got to do something new. And that growing of faith is painful. Like, my legs were hurting because I'm doing a new exercise. And sometimes the journey of faith is painful, but it requires us to step out of our comfort zone and do new things. And on my bedroom wall when I was growing up, I had this quote, and it said, from Hudson Taylor, if there's no element of risk in our exploits for God, if we don't take any risks, then there's no need for faith. So if we are taking risks, if some things are uncomfortable in life, which I'm sure they are for most people, then that leads us to greater dependence on something or someone. And for me, yeah, some of the times it's on God, sometimes it's more in God, sometimes, you know, I can slip into trusting in other things. But yeah, there's a good reminder even for myself tonight to make sure I exercise my faith and commit to using my talents, because through using your talents, it's about, yeah, growing in faith and trusting in Him. So
thank you. We've got some time before we kick you out of the building, so please do talk to Simon. Ask him lots of questions. Also, you know, we're aware that probably in this room there we're in lots of different places on a journey of faith, and if that conversation about faith is something that you'd like to pick up as well, please do chat to, again, myself or Simon. Just a few things to alert you to. The first that's already been mentioned is that it is Father's Day today. This morning we were able to give out chocolate bars which say Happy Father's Day and have a verse on them. So perhaps if you are, if you didn't receive one of them this morning and you are male or have played any father role, let's not be too gender specific, do help yourself to a chocolate bar. Or you might even want to take it away and give it to someone who's been a significant parent, father figure in your life. The next Sunday conversation should be on the 21st of July. We are currently, the speaker who we've lined up has currently got some family situations going on where she is hoping to be able to commit, but it's slightly up in the air. So please do watch this space. Check on the church website, the posters outside, the bulletin if you're someone who comes here. And we're hoping that that will be able to run as normal, but we'll let you know if it doesn't. Just another mentioning faith, another event that we'd love to plug is the Men's Golf Day, which is gender specific, I'm afraid, more so than Father's Day. That's coming up on Monday. Maybe the same as Father's Day. That's coming up on the 8th of July, and that is a day of golf for anyone who you might know who is male or willing to pretend for the day and to come and play golf. But in the evening, there's a talk by John Blanchard, which is a gospel presentation. What does it mean to give your life to Christ and be a follower of Christ? So it might be that you'd like to be there as a golfer or just for the evening as someone who's interested to hear that talk, or you might want to invite someone else. There are flyers for that at the back. I wonder if we could show a huge amount of appreciation to Simon.
Cheers.